allowing his thoughts to be totally readable by the others, though only Farid and Flavius, it seemed, could read them. He was a mystery to Seth, and Seth was a mystery to him, common enough to the early generation. "Why would anyone want to be the host of the Sacred Core?" Gregory asked. Seth didn't immediately answer. Then, in a quiet, distinct voice, he spoke. "You suspect me of conniving, don't you? You think our work here is reducible to some simple plot to gain power over the Source?" "No, that's not true," Gregory said. He'd been astonished. He might have been insulted, but it wasn't his way ever to be insulted. Seth was staring at him as if he loathed Gregory, and Gregory realized that he was at a significant turning point. He could loathe Seth now as well, if he chose to do it. He could fear him, give in to jealousy of his age and power. He didn't want to do this. He had thought sadly then of how he had dreamed of encounters such as this, dreaming of making himself known to the great Maharit simply to talk to her, talk and talk and talk, the way he was always talking to his beloved little family who never really understood what he was talking about. He had looked away. He would not despise Seth, and he would not seek to intimidate him. If he had learned one thing from his long time in this world, it was that he could intimidate others beyond his wildest intentions to do it. When a statue talks to you, a statue that can breathe and move, it's faintly horrible. But with Farid and Seth, Gregory had wanted something warm, something vital. "I want us to be brothers," he had said to Seth in a low voice. "I wish there were a good word for brothers and sisters the world over, something more specific than kindred. But you are my kindred, both of you. I've exchanged blood with you, and that makes you my special kindred. But we are all kindred." He had stared helplessly at the ornamental fireplace. Black-veined marble, French gilt, flashing gold andirons. He let his preternatural hearing rise. He heard the voices beyond the glass, the voices of millions in soft, undulating waves, punctuated by the music of cries, prayers, laughter. Farid began to talk, then talk of his immediate work and how Flavius would now have to use this living leg he had affixed so skilfully. And on he went about the fine points of the long surgery during which the leg had been attached, about the nature of the blood, how it behaved so distinctly from human blood. He used a multitude of Latin words which Gregory could not understand. "But what is this thing, Amel?" Gregory said suddenly. "Oh, forgive me that I don't know what all these words mean. But what is this animating force inside us? How has it changed the blood to the blood?" Farid seemed enjoyably absorbed in the question as he responded. "This thing, this monster, Amel, it's made up of nanoparticles. How can I describe it? Made up of cells infinitely smaller than the tiniest eukaryote cells known to us. But cells, you understand. It has a cellular life, dimensions, boundaries, some sort of nervous system, a brain or nucleus of some sort that governs its physicality and its etheric properties. It once had intelligence, if we are to believe the witches. It once possessed a voice."
"You mean you can see these cells under a microscope?" Gregory asked.
"Not at all," said Farid. "I can't. I know its properties by how they behave. When a creature is made into a vampire, it's as if a tentacle of this monster invades the new organism, hooking itself into the brain of the human being and then slowly beginning to transform it. Senescence is stopped forever. And then the alchemical blood of the creature works on the human blood, slowly absorbing it and then transforming what it does not absorb. It works on all the biological tissue. It becomes the sole source of cell development and change within the host. Are you following me?"
"Well, yes, I think I've always understood that," said Gregory.
"Now it needs more human blood to continue its work."
"And what's the goal of its work?" asked Flavius.
"To make us into perfect hosts for itself," said Farid.
"And to drink blood, "'Always to drink more blood,' said Gregory. "'To drive us to drink more blood. "'I remember how the Queen cried out in those early months. "'The thirst was unbearable. "'It wanted more blood. "'The red-haired witches told her that before they'd been given the blood. "'It wants more blood. "'But I don't think that is its main goal,' said Farid. "'Nor has it ever been. "'But I'm not sure that it is conscious of a goal.' That is what I want to know more than anything. Is it self-conscious? Is it a conscious being living inside the body of Makari?
But in the very beginning, Gregory said, the spirits of the world told the twin witches that Amel, once fused with the queen, was not conscious. They said Amel is no more. They said Amel was lost now, inside the mother.
Farid laughed to himself and looked into the fire.
"'I was there,' said Gregory. "'I remember it, when the twins said these things.' "'Well, of course you were. "'But what amazes me is that after all the generations you've seen rise and fall, "'you still believe those spirits actually spoke to the witches.'
"'I know they did.'
"'Do you?' asked Farid.
"'Yes,' said Gregory. "'I do know.'
"'Well, you may be right, and the spirits may be right, "'and the thing is mindless and subsumed, but I cannot help but wonder.' I tell you, there are no discarnate entities. This thing, Amel, is not a discarnate entity, but something of immense size and intricate organization, something that has now so thoroughly mutated its host and those connected to her.
And suddenly his language ascended again into a vocabulary as opaque to Gregory as the syllables uttered by dolphins or birds. Gregory tried to pierce the language with the finest abilities of his own mind, to see the pictures, shapes behind it. Design. But he saw something that resembled the stars in the night sky, and their infinite and purely accidental patterns. Farid continued,
I suspect these creatures, which we have for thousands of years called spirits or ghosts, these creatures draw their nourishment from the atmosphere, and just how they perceive us is impossible to know. There is a beauty to it, I suspect, a beauty as there is to all of nature, and they are part of nature.
Beauty, Gregory said. I believe there is beauty in all things. I believe that. But I must find the beauty and coherence in science, or I'll never learn, never understand.
Listen to me, said Farid gently. I was brought over because this is my field, my language, my realm, all this. You need not ever fully understand it. You can't understand any more than Lestat or Marius or Maharet can understand it, or millions of people out there who have no capacity to absorb scientific knowledge or use it any way other than the simplest and most practical.
I am that cripple here, said Gregory, nodding.
But trust in me. Said Farid. Trust in me that I study for us, what I can study that no human scientist can possibly study, and don't think they haven't tried, they have.
Oh, I know, said Gregory.
He thought back on those long-ago nights in 1985, after Lestat's famous San Francisco rock concert, of the scientists who gathered up what they could of those burnt remains all over the parking lots surrounding the concert hall. He'd watched that with the coldest detachment. But nothing, absolutely nothing, had come of it, any more than anything ever came of the vampires who were now and then captured by scientists, imprisoned in labs, and studied until they made their spectacular escapes, or were spectacularly rescued. Nothing came of it, except that now the world was inhabited by some 30 or 40 frantic men and women of science, who claimed there were real vampires out there, and they had seen them with their own eyes. Outcasts from their profession, whom the world branded lunatics. Time was when Gregory left the security of his Geneva penthouse to rescue any misbegotten little vampire who'd ended up in a laboratory prison under fluorescent lights, gazed on by government officials. He'd hastened to break them out, destroy whatever evidence had been collected, but now he scarcely bothered. It didn't matter. Vampires didn't exist, and everybody knew that. All the amusing popular novels, television series, and motion pictures about vampires served to reinforce the common wisdom. Besides, captured vampires almost always escaped,
They were plenty strong. If caught in confusion and weakness, they collected themselves, bided their time, seduced their captives with cooperative speech, then shattered skulls, burnt laboratories, and scampered back off into the great and unending shadow world of the undead, leaving behind not a scintilla of evidence that they had ever been lab rats. Didn't happen very often, anyway. Farid was aware of all this. He had to be. Farid, with or without their help, would find out everything. Farid laughed. He laughed easily and cheerfully, with his entire face, his green eyes crinkled and his lips smiling. He'd been reading Gregory's mind. "You are so right," he said, "so very right. And some of those poor ostracized researchers who scraped up the oily residue of mythic monsters from the asphalt are working with me now in this very building. They make the most willing pupils of what Seth and I have to offer." Gregory smiled. "That's not at all surprising." He had never thought to bring such creatures into the blood. On that long-ago night in San Francisco, when Lestat's concert had ended in a flaming massacre, his one thought had been to rescue his precious Davis from the Holocaust. Let the doctors of the human world do what they would with the bones and slime that dead blood-drinkers had left behind. He'd taken Davis in his arms and gone up high into the heavens before the Queen could fix him with her lethal eyes, and only later had he returned, the boy safe now as the Queen had moved on, to watch from a distance those forensic workers gathering their evidence. He had thought of Davis then as he sat with Farid in Los Angeles, thought of Davis's dark caramel skin and those thick black eyelashes so common in males of African descent. Nearly 20 years had passed since the night of that concert, yet Davis was just now coming into himself, recovering from the deep wounds of his early exile in the blood. He was again dancing, as he had long ago in New York as a mortal boy, before intense anxiety had crushed his chances for the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theatre and sent him into the awful mental decline in which he'd been made a vampire. Ah, well, that was another story. Davis had taught Gregory things about this age which Gregory could have never divined on his own. Davis had a soft, silky voice that always made his simplest statements sound like the most hallowed confidences, and a touch that was eternally gentle, and the gentlest gaze. Davis had become a blood spouse to Gregory as surely as Chrysanthi, and she too loved Davis. In the severe and modern drawing-room in Los Angeles, with its impressionist paintings and French fireplace, Farid had sat quiet for a long time, thinking to himself, shielding his ruminations perfectly. At last he'd said gently, "You must tell no one about Victor." This was Lestat's biological son. "Of course not, but they will know. They will all eventually know. Surely the twins know now." "Perhaps they do," said Seth. "Perhaps they don't. Perhaps they are beyond caring what happens to us in this world." His voice was not cold or hostile. He spoke evenly and politely. "Perhaps they have not come to us because they are indifferent to what we do here." "Whatever the case, you must keep the secret," Farid thought. "We will be moving soon from this building to a safer, more remote compound. It will be safer there for Victor." "Has the boy no normal human life?" Gregory asked. "I don't mean to challenge your judgment. I am only asking." "Actually, more than you might think. After all, by day he's quite safe with the bodyguards we provide for him, is he not? And again, what would anyone gain from making him a hostage? Someone has to want something before he takes a hostage. What has Lestat to give but himself? And whatever that is, it cannot be extorted." Gregory nodded, somewhat relieved when he considered it in that light. It would have been rude to push for more information. But, of course, there was a reason to take him hostage, to demand Lestat's or Seth's powerful blood. Better not to point this out. He had to leave this mystery in their hands. But he secretly wondered if Lestat de Liancourt wouldn't be furious when he discovered the existence of Victor. Lestat was known for having a temper almost as extreme as his sense of humour. Before that night was finished, Farid had made a few more statements about vampiric nature. "Oh, if only I knew," he said, "whether that thing is truly unconscious, or whether it retains an autonomous life, and whether or not it wants something. All life wants something. All life moves towards something."
"And what are we, then?" Gregory had asked.
"We are mutants," Farid answered. "We are a fusion of unrelated species, and the force in us which turns our human blood into vampire blood is making of us something perfect. But what that is, what that will be, what that must be, I do not know."
"He wanted to be physical," said Seth. "That was well known in olden times. Amel wanted to be flesh and blood, and he got what he wanted, and he lost himself in the process."
"Perhaps," said Farid. "But does anyone really want to be mortal flesh and blood? What all beings want is to be immortal flesh and blood. And this monster has come closer to that, perhaps, than any spirit who temporarily possesses a child or a nun or a psychic."
"Not if he's lost himself in the process," said Seth.
"You speak as if Akasha possessed him," said Farid. "But it was his goal to possess her, remember?" This had frightened Gregory, and it had taught him something. For all his protests of wanting to learn about all things, for loving and embracing the ever-evolving world, well, he was frightened of this new knowledge that Farid was acquiring, truly frightened of it. For the first time he knew well why religious humans so feared scientific advances, and he discovered the heart of superstition in himself. Well, he would suppress this fear. He would annihilate this superstition in himself, and work diligently on his old faith. The next night they had embraced, for the final time, right after sunset. Gregory had been surprised when Seth came forward and took Gregory in his arms.
"I am your brother," he whispered.
But this he said in the ancient tongue, the ancient tongue no longer spoken anywhere under the moon or the sun.
"Forgive me that I've been cold to you. I feared you."
"And I feared you," Gregory confessed, the old language coming back to him in a flood of sorrow. "My brother. Queen's blood and blood kindred."
"No, something greater, infinitely greater. And brother does not betray brother."
"You are too much alike, you two," said Farid gently. "You even resemble each other. Same high cheekbones, same slightly slanted eyes, same jet-black hair."
"Oh, some night in the far future, I will complete a DNA study of every immortal on the planet, and what will that tell us about our human ancestors as well as our blood ancestors?" Seth had embraced Gregory all the more warmly after that, and Gregory had returned the affection with all his heart. Back in Geneva, he kept the secret of Victor even from Chrysanthi. He kept it as well from Davis, Zenobia, and Avicus. Flavius kept the secret as well. Flavius learned to trust his new and perfect limb over the coming months, until it was truly part of him. Years had passed since then. The undead world knew nothing of Victor, and Farid had told no one of Gregory Duff Collingsworth or his preternatural clan. And 2 years ago, when Gregory came to spy on Lestat with David and Jesse in Paris, he'd realized that Lestat still had no inkling of Victor's existence. He'd also learned, as he eavesdropped on the three in their hotel room confab, that Farid and Seth were still thriving, though now in a new compound in the California desert, and that Maharit herself had gone to Farid for his skills. That had reassured him greatly. He did not want to think of the twins as creatures of ambition. He dreaded the very possibility, and it had greatly comforted him to learn that Farid's scans and imaging equipment had detected no mind in the mute Makari. Yes, that was better than a host of Akasha's ambitions and ultimate dreams. But it had tormented him that night in Paris, as he eavesdropped, to hear Jesse Reeves talk of the little massacre in the library archive of Maharit's household, and of Cayman's confusion and pain. Cayman had always been on the edge of madness, as far as Gregory was concerned. Every time Cayman had ever come across Gregory's path, he had been more or less out of his mind. In the age of Rochamandis, he'd been Benjamin the Devil. and eventually the Talamasca had studied him under that name. But then Gregory considered the Talamasca to be harmless, as Caiman was harmless. He was the perfect vampire for their treatises. Imbeciles like Benjamin the Devil and fast talkers like Lestat kept them believing the undead were harmless and more interesting alive than dead. And to think, before that horrid massacre in Maharit's compound, the Great One had actually been spying on him, on Gregory, in Geneva, and she'd been contemplating a meeting involving them all. That intelligence, too, had deepened Gregory's excitement and his dread. How he would love to talk to Maharit now, if only... But his nerve had failed him 2 years ago, when he had first heard of these things in his spying on Jesse Reeves, and his nerve failed him now. Now, in the year 2013, as Gregory stood in Central Park in this warm September night, watching, listening, as inside the house called Trinity Gate, Armand and Louis and Sabelle and Benji gathered around their new companion Antoine, all of this weighed on Gregory's heart. Was Lestat still completely ignorant of Victor's existence? And where were the twins at this very hour? Gregory realized he'd not be joining Armand and Louis and the others tonight, even if the loveliest music on earth was now coming from the townhouse, with Antoine playing his violin as Sibelle played the piano, both of them traveling the exhilarating crescendos of Tchaikovsky, effortlessly inflating the music with their own madness and charm. But the time would certainly come when they must all meet. And how many would die by fire before such a gathering took place? He turned and headed deeper into the darkness of Central Park, walking faster and faster, his thoughts crowding in on him as he pondered whether to stay in this city or go home. He had spent last night in his penthouse apartment on Central Park South, and assured himself all was in order should he have to bring his family there. He was the owner of the building, and his basement crypts were as safe as those of Louis and Armand. No need to go back there now. He longed for Geneva, for his own lair. Suddenly, without the conscious decision, he was ascending, and so rapidly that no mortal eye could have followed his progress, rising ever higher and turning eastward as the city of New York receded below him, yet remained a wondrous and endless carpet of brilliant and pulsing lights. Oh, what do the great electrified cities of this world look like to heaven? What do they look like to me? Perhaps these urban galaxies of electric splendor offered to the endless heavens an homage, a mirror image of the stars. Cutting higher and higher, he fought the wind that would stop him until he had broken into the thinnest air beneath the vast canopy of silent stars. Home. He wanted to go home. A vague panic seized him. Even as he moved eastward and out over the cold black Atlantic, he heard the voice of Benji Mahmoud broadcasting again. His brief visit with Antoine had apparently been interrupted by frightening intelligence.
It has happened now in Amman. The vampires of Amman have been massacred. It is the burning children of the night. We are now certain of it. But we have reports of massacres in other places, random places. We are trying to confirm now whether shelters in Bolivia have been attacked.
Pushed to the limit of his strength, Gregory travelled faster towards the European continent, desperate suddenly to be at his own hearth. For the ancient ones, Chrysanthi, Flavius, Zenobia, and Avicus, he had little fear as Benji's frantic appeals faded into the roar of the wind. But what about his beloved Davis? Could it possibly be that his beloved Davis would once again suffer the hot breath of the burning which had so nearly taken him from the earth once before? All was well when he arrived, but it was almost dawn. He'd lost half the night in travelling east, and he was weary to the core of his soul. There was time to embrace Flavius and Davis, but Zenobia and Avicus had already gone to the vaults beneath the 10-story hotel. How fresh and beautiful Davis looked to him with his shining dark skin and liquid eyes. He had hunted that night in Zurich with Flavius, and they'd only just returned. Gregory caught the scent of the human blood in him.
"And all's well with the people of Trinity Gate?" asked Davis.
He was eager to return to New York, Gregory knew this, eager to revisit his old home in Harlem and the places where once, as a young man, he had sought to be a Broadway dancer. He was convinced the past could not hurt him now, but he wanted to put his hopes to the test. In a hushed voice, Gregory told him that his old compatriot, Killer of the Fang Gang, was alive, that the young musician Antoine had met him on his journey to New York. This assuaged an old guilt in Davis, guilt that he had been rescued from Akasha's massacre after Lestat's concert, leaving Killer to perish.
"Maybe somehow a great good will come out of this," Davis said, searching Gregory's face. "Maybe somehow Benji's dream is possible. Do you think that we could all come together? In the old days it was every gang for itself. It was back alleys and gutters and graveyards."
"I know," said Gregory.
They had been over many times how the undead had lived before Lestat had raised his voice and told them the story of their beginnings. Vampire bars, swanky coven houses, and roving gangs. Yes, all of that.
"Can there be a way for us to live in peace?" Davis asked.
Obviously he felt so safe here under Gregory's watchful eye that the stories of the new burnings did not frighten him, not at all, not the way they frightened Gregory.
"Is it possible we could really embrace a future? You know, we never had a future in those nights. We just had the past, and the now, and then, the outskirts of life."
"I know," said Gregory.
He kissed Davis and sent him away with only the gentlest warning.
"Go nowhere without me, without Flavius, without one of us."
Davis, like all his little family, had never rebelled against him. Gregory had only a few precious moments alone to look out on placid and lovely Lake Geneva and the bright, broad quay below, where early morning strollers were already out, and the vendors offering hot chocolate and coffee, and then to go upstairs, as he did every morning, to his own glass cell on the roof. Geneva was quiet. There had never been a coven house or refuge in Geneva, and as far as Gregory could tell, there were no undead mavericks challenging him here. If there was a target for the burning, however, it was this building where he and his beloved family lodged. Tomorrow he'd strengthen all security systems, sprinklers, and examine the vaults to make certain that the thick stone and lead walls were unbreachable. He was no stranger to the fire gift. He knew what it could do and what it could not do. He'd foiled Akasha when she sought to burn Davis simply by carrying him upwards so swiftly her eyes could not follow the escape. And throughout the night time from now on, he would keep the young and vulnerable Davis at his side. Now he mounted the steel-lined stairway and pushed back the heavy-plated doors to his small open bedroom under the sky. In this roofless, high-walled cell, under a high canopy of steel mesh, he would endure the paralysis of the daylight hours, exposing his 6,000-year-old body to the burning rays of the sun. When he woke each night, of course, he knew a slight discomfort from this exposure, but as the result of this process his skin remained darkly tanned, helping him to pass for human, never to become the living white marble statue that Cayman had become that would so frighten human beings. As he lay down on his soft bed, the sky brightening above him, he picked up the book he'd been studying. Glass, A World History, by Ellen MacFarlane and Jerry Martin, and read for a few precious minutes from this engrossing text. Some night soon, somehow, he and Lestat would sit together somewhere in a panelled library or a breezy open café, and they would talk together, talk and talk and talk, and Gregory would not be so alone. Lestat would really understand. And Lestat would teach Gregory things. Yes, surely that would happen, and that is what Gregory longed for more than anything else. He was just sliding into unconsciousness when he heard dim telepathic cries from somewhere in the world.
The burning!
But that was some place where the sun was not shining, and the sun was indeed shining here, and Gregory sank into sleep beneath its warm, penetrating rays now, because he could do nothing else.
10. Everard de Landen. He wanted no part of this voice telling him to burn the young ones. He wanted no part of wars, or factions, or covens, or books about vampires. And certainly he wanted nothing to do with any entity who said solemnly and telepathically, "I am the voice. Do as I say." The very idea, he had laughed. "And why don't you want to slaughter them?" demanded the voice. "Have they not driven you out of Rome?"
"No, they haven't. And I do wish you'd go away."
Everard knew from bad experience that it was not in the vampire nature to collect in groups, except for evil, and that fighting other blood drinkers was a foolish enterprise that ended only in ruin for all involved. He had long chosen to survive alone. In the hills of Tuscany, not far from Siena, he kept a small refurbished villa staffed by mortals, and in the evenings the rooms were his alone. He was coldly hospitable to the immortals who now and then called on him, but this voice wanted it to begin all over again, and he would not listen. He went into Rome or Florence to hunt, because they provided the only really safe and rich hunting grounds, but he would not go into Rome to burn. 700 years ago, he had been made in France by a great vampire named Rochamandes, who had created a line of de Landen vampires, as he called them, Benedict, Alessandra, Eleni, Eugenie, Notker, and Everard, most of which had no doubt perished over the centuries, but Everard had survived. True, he'd been captured by the coven of the Children of Satan, those infamous superstitious vampires who made of their miserable existence a religion, and he'd served them, but only after he'd been tortured and starved. Sometime in the Renaissance years, he couldn't remember precisely when, he'd been sent by the vicious little Parisian coven master Armand to the Children of Satan in Rome to find out how the coven fared. Well, the coven had been in ruins, and Santino, the coven master, had been living a blasphemous existence in worldly clothes and jewels, flouting all the rules he'd forced on others. And Everard saw his chance. He escaped the Children of Satan, striking out on his own, remembering the things that the powerful Rochamandes had taught him long ago, before the Children of Satan drove him from France. Since then, Everard had survived many an encounter with others more powerful than himself. He'd survived the terrible burning, when Akasha passed over the world striking down children of darkness everywhere, without regard to character, courage, merit, or mercy. He'd even survived a brief and insulting mention in one of the vampire chronicles by Marius, who described Everard, without naming him, as gaunt and big-boned, with dusty clothes and dirty lace. Well, he could endure the gaunt and big-boned, that was true, and he thought himself quite beautiful in spite of it, but the dusty clothes and dirty lace, it infuriated him. He kept his shoulder-length black hair and his clothes immaculate. If he ever ran into Marius again, he intended to smack his face. But that was all foolishness, really. If he played his cards right, he'd never run into Marius or anyone else, except to exchange a few kind words and then move on. The point was, Everard lived with other blood drinkers at peace. And now this inane voice, this voice that came right into his head, bedeviled him nightly with commands to kill and to burn and to rampage. And he could not shut this voice out. Finally, he'd resorted to music. Everard had started purchasing excellent systems for amplified music since the beginning of the 20th century. Indeed, the storerooms of his little villa were a veritable museum, as he hated to throw good things away, and so he had wind-up Victrolas, stacks of thick old black phonograph records that he had once played on them, as well as early electrical machines that had once given him high fidelity and stereo, and now collected dust. He'd moved on to compact discs, streaming, and the like, and so forth, and so putting his iPhone into the little Bose dock that would amplify its music, he flooded the villa with the Ride of the Valkyries, and prayed the voice would go away. No such luck. The imbecilic, bad-tempered, and childish little monster continued to invade his thoughts.
"You are not going to persuade me to burn anyone, you idiot!" Everard snarled with exasperation. "I will punish you for this.
"You are young and weak and stupid," said the voice. "And when I do accomplish my purpose, I will send an ancient one to destroy you for your disobedience."
"Oh, stuff it up your chimney, you vain little nuisance," said Everard. "If you are so high and mighty and capable of doing this, why are you talking to me at all? And why aren't you blasting all the blood-drinker tramps of Rome on your own?" Who was this fool? Some ancient one buried deep underground, or walled up in some ruin somewhere, desperately trying to control others and ultimately draw them to his prison? Well, he was doing a very bad job of it, with all this incitement to war and idle threats.
"I shall make you suffer," said the voice, "and turn off that infernal music."
Everard laughed. He turned the volume higher, took the iPhone out of the dock, put it in his pocket, connected the earpiece, and went out for a walk. The voice fumed, but he could hardly hear it. It was a lovely route he took downhill to the walled city of Siena, and how Everard loved the place, with its tiny, winding, medieval streets that made him feel safe, made him think of his Paris. The Paris of today terrified him. He even loved the bright-faced and gentle tourists who flooded Siena, pretty much enjoying what Everard enjoyed, wandering, gazing into shop windows, and sitting in the wine bars. Everard liked the shops, and wished more were open after dark. He often sent his mortal servants down to purchase stationery for him, on which to write his occasional poems, which he then framed and hung on his walls. And he purchased scented candles, and bright silk neckties. Like many of the old ones made in the Middle Ages, he favoured ornate and big-sleeved shirts, tight-fitting pants that were almost like leggings, and fancy, mostly velvet, coats. And these things he ordered online with his big, dazzling Mac computer. But the town had fine men's gloves and golden cufflinks and such, lots of glittering accoutrements. He had a lot of money, accumulated over the centuries in many ways. He wasn't hungry. He'd fed in Florence the night before, and it had been a long, slow, delicious feast. And so on this cool and mild evening, under the Tuscan stars, he was happy, even though the voice grumbled in his ear. He entered the town with a nod to the few people he actually knew who gave him a wave as he passed, the gaunt one with the big bones, and followed the narrow street in the direction of the cathedral. Soon he came to the café he liked the most. It sold newspapers and magazines and had a few tables set out on the street. Most of the patrons were inside tonight, as it was just a little chilly for them, but for a vampire the weather was perfect. Everard sat down, switching the music feed from Wagner to Vivaldi, whom he liked much better, and waited for the waiter to bring him his usual, a cup of hot American coffee, which of course he could not and would not drink. Years ago, he used to go to great lengths to make it appear that he ate and drank. Now he knew it was a waste of time. In a world such as this, where people consumed food and drink for amusement as well as nourishment, nobody cared if he left a mug full of coffee on a café table, so long as he left a generous tip. He left huge tips. He settled back in the little iron chair, which was likely made of aluminium, and began to hum with the Vivaldi violin music as his eyes passed over the darkly stained old facades that surrounded him, the eternal architecture of Italy that had survived so many changes, just as he had. Quite suddenly, his heart stopped. In the café across from him, seated at an outdoor table with their backs to the tall building behind them, sat an ancient vampire and what appeared to be two ghosts. Everard was too terrified to even take a breath. At once he thought of the threat of the voice. And here sat this ancient one, not 50 feet from him, the colour of waxen gardenias, with bright, deep-set black eyes and short, well-groomed, snow-white hair, looking directly at Everard as if he knew him. And beside him these two ghosts, clothed in bodies of particles, though how he knew not, both staring at him too. These creatures appeared friendly. What was the chance of that? These ghosts were magnificent, no doubt about that. Their bodies appeared wondrously solid and appeared to be breathing. He could even hear their hearts. And they wore real clothes, these ghosts. So very clever. But ghosts had been getting better and better at passing for human for centuries. Everard had been seeing them in one form or another ever since he was born. Few had been able to form particle bodies for themselves in those long-ago days, but now it was fairly common. He frequently glimpsed them in Rome in particular. But of all the modern apparitions he'd seen on city streets throughout Europe, these two were absolutely the best. One ghost, the nearest to the ancient vampire, appeared to be a man of perhaps 50, with wavy iron-grey hair and a somewhat noble face. His bright eyes were crinkled with a friendly expression, and he had an agreeable, almost pretty mouth. Beside him sat the illusion of a man in his prime, with short, well-groomed ashen hair and grey eyes. All were neatly dressed in what anyone in this day and age would call fine and respectable clothes. The younger male ghost had a proud bearing and actually turned his head and looked about him as if he were enjoying these moments in the busy little street, no matter why the trio had come here. The vampire with the full, well-groomed white hair gave a little nod to Everard, and Everard went silently crazy. He sent the telepathic message,
"Well, damn you, blast me if you intend to do it. I'm too frightened to be civil. Get on with it, but first, I demand that you tell me why."
He killed the music from the iPhone. He didn't want to die with a soundtrack, and he fully expected to hear the voice, raging and cackling exultantly. But the voice was not there.
"Miserable coward," he muttered. "You order my death and decamp without even remaining here to witness it? And you wanted me to burn down the Roman vampire refuge in the Via Condotti? Well, you're ugly, and you're mad."
The ancient vampire across the way rose to his feet and gestured in a decidedly friendly manner for Everard to join them. He was not overly tall, and he was very delicate of build. He took a chair from a nearby table and placed it in their circle. He waited patiently for Everard's response. It was as if Everard had forgotten how to walk. All his life in the undead, he'd seen vampires burned by others, seen that horrific spectacle of a living, breathing creature going up in a personal inferno because some older, more powerful vampire, like that contemptible, condescending Marius, had decided he or she should die. His legs were wobbling so badly as he crossed the street, he thought he would at any moment collapse. His narrow, tailored leather jacket felt heavy, and his boots pinched, and he wondered inanely whether his blue silk tie had a stain on it, and whether the cuffs of his lavender shirt were sticking too far out of his coat sleeves. His hands were shaking visibly as he reached to accept the hard, icy hand of the old vampire, but he managed it. He managed to sit down. The ghosts were smiling at him, and they were even more perfect than he'd thought. Yes, they breathed. They had internal organs, and yes, they were wearing real clothes. Nothing illusory about that dark worsted wool, or linen and silk. And no doubt all this superb tissue could vanish in a twinkling, and the costly clothes would drop to the ground on top of the empty shoes. The old vampire placed a hand on Everard's shoulder. He had small but long fingers, and he wore two stunning gold rings. This was a traditional way vampires greeted each other, not with embraces, not with kisses, but with the placing of the hand on the shoulder. Everard remembered that from times when he had lived amongst them.
"Young one," he said with a characteristic pomposity of the elder blood drinkers, "please do not be afraid."
He spoke in Parisian French. Up close, the Ancient One's face was truly impressive. Very fine of feature, with exquisite black eyelashes and a serene smile. High cheekbones, a firm, discernible yet narrow jaw. His skin did look like the petal of a gardenia in the moonlight, yes, and his white hair had a subtle, silvery sheen. He hadn't been born to darkness with that hair. Rochamandes, Everard's maker, had long ago explained that when some of the Ancient Ones were badly burnt, their hair was white forever after. Well, it was that kind of magnificent white hair.
"We know you've heard the voice," said this Ancient One. "I too have heard it. Others have heard it. Are you hearing it now?"
"No," said Everard.
"And it's telling you to burn others, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Everard. "I have never harmed another blood drinker.
Never had to, never want to. I've lived in this part of Italy for almost 400 years. I don't go into Rome or Florence to fight with people.
I know, said the Ancient One.
It was a pleasing voice, a gentle voice. But then all the old ones had good voices, at least as far as Everard had ever observed. What he remembered more than anything else about his maker, Rosamandi's, was his seductive voice, and that voice luring him into the forest on the night he was born to darkness against his will. Everard had thought the lord in the castle was summoning him for an erotic encounter, that afterwards he'd be dismissed with a few coins if he'd managed to please, and that he would have tales of tapestry-covered walls and blazing fires and fine clothes to tell his grandchildren. Ha! He could remember Rosamandi's talking to him as if it were last night. You are surely one of the most beautiful young men in your village.
My name is Tescarmen,
said this Ancient One, who was looking at him with such mild, gracious eyes.
I come from old Egypt. I was a servant of the Mother.
Doesn't everyone say that these days, since the publication of the Vampire Chronicles?
Asked Everard angrily before he could stop himself.
Do any of you ever cop to having been a renegade or some clever menace who wheedled the blood from a gypsy blood drinker in a ragged caravan?
The Ancient One laughed out loud, but it was a good-natured laugh.
Well, I see I have indeed put you at your ease, he said, and that didn't prove to be hard after all.
His face grew serious.
Do you have any idea who the voice might be?
You're asking me? Everard scoffed. You must have 2,000 years in the blood. Look at you.
He glared at the two ghosts.
Don't you know who he is?
He flashed back at Tescarmen.
That little monster's driving me crazy. I can't shut him out.
Tescarmen nodded.
I'm sorry to hear that, but it is possible to ignore him. It takes patience and skill, but it can be done.
Oh, blah, 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 said Everard. He sticks his invisible needle through my temple. He must be in the vicinity.
He glared again at the two ghosts. They didn't even shiver. Sometimes ghosts did that when you glared directly at them. The apparitions shivered or quivered, but not these two. The one who appeared to be an older man extended his ghostly hand. Everard took it, discovering it felt entirely human, and that it was warm and soft.
Raymond Galant, said the ghost in English, if you'll allow it, I'm your friend.
Magnus, said the younger male ghost.
His was a marvellous face for anyone, ghost or blood drinker, or mortal for that matter. His eyes crinkled again agreeably as he smiled, and he did indeed have a particularly beautiful mouth, what people call a generous mouth, as well-formed as the Apollo Belvedere. His forehead was beautiful, and his hair moving back from it in waves of ashen blonde was handsome. Those names rang a bell, but Everard couldn't place them. Raymond, Galant, Magnus?
I don't think the voice is in the vicinity, said Tescarmen. I think he can be any place that he wants to be, anywhere in the world. But it does seem he can only be in one place at a time. And, of course, that place is inside a blood drinker's mind.
Which means what exactly? Demanded Everard. How's he doing it? Who is he?
That is what we would like to know, said Raymond Galant.
Again he spoke in British English. Everard switched into English immediately. He liked the brashness of English, and he had become entirely used to it as the language of the world today. But Everard's English was American.
"What are you, a blood drinker, doing with two ghosts?"
he asked Tescarmen.
"No offence intended, believe me. It's only that I've never seen a blood drinker keep company with ghosts."
"Well, we do keep company,"
said the iron-haired apparition, the one who appeared to be an older man.
"We have for a long time. But I assure you we have no evil designs on you or anyone."
"Then why are you here and asking me questions about this voice?"
"He's inciting violence all over the world right now," said Tescarmen.
Young blood drinkers are being slain in small towns and cities everywhere. This happened once before, but we know the cause of that massacre. We don't know the cause of what's going on now, and blood drinkers are being quietly annihilated in out-of-the-way places, and even in their private sanctuaries, without anyone taking notice.
Then how did you notice? Asked Everard.
We hear things, said the ghost, named Magnus. Deep, smooth voice.
Everard nodded.
There's an American vampire out of New York broadcasting about it, said Everard with a faint sneer. There was something insufferably vulgar about those words, and he was mortified suddenly to have spoken them. But at once the three beings all confirmed agreeably that they already knew.
Benji Mahmoud, said Tescarman.
He's as addle-brained as the voice, said Everard. The little numbskull thinks we're a tribe.
Well, we are, aren't we?
Asked the Ancient One gently.
I always thought we were. We were in olden times.
Well, not now, said Everard. Listen, this voice thing promised to destroy me if I didn't do its bidding. Do you think it has the power to do that? Can it do that?
It appears to work in a fairly simple way, said Tescarman. It rouses old ones to burn others, and young ones to burn their lairs. And I suspect it depends entirely on finding gullible and susceptible servants. It seems to have no other plan.
Then it can rouse some gullible or susceptible one to stamp out me.
We'll tell you what we can to prevent that, said Tescarman.
Why would you bother? Asked Everard.
We truly are all one tribe,
said the iron-haired ghost softly.
Human, vampire, spirit, ghost. We're all sentient creatures bound to this planet. Why can't we work together in the face of something like this?
And to what end? Asked Everard.
To stop the voice, said Tescarman, with just a trace of impatience, to prevent it from hurting others.
But we deserve to be hurt, said Everard.
Don't we?
He was surprised to hear this come out of his mouth.
No, I don't think that we do, said Tescarman. That's the kind of thinking that has to change. That's the kind of thinking that will change.
Oh, wait, don't tell me,
Everard declared,
and in a mock American voice he said, we are the change that we seek.
Well,
tell me you believe that, and I'm going to fall off this chair and roll into the street laughing.
The three smiled at him, but he could sense that, polite as they were, they did not like being mocked, and he was suddenly sorry. It penetrated to him with amazing sharpness that these three had been nothing but kind and courteous, and that he was behaving crossly and stupidly, wasting these moments. And for what?
Why can't we come together, asked the younger male ghost, to achieve some kind of peace for the realm we share?
And what realm is that? Asked Everard. Since you're a ghost, my friend, and I'm flesh and blood, no matter how loathsome I am.
I was a human being once, said the younger ghost. I was a blood drinker for centuries after that, and I am a ghost now, and my soul has been my soul in all three forms.
Blood drinker, murmured Everard. He was marveling, studying the face of this ghost again, and that generous, kindly mouth and the expressive eyes.
Magnus, he said with a start. Not Magnus the alchemist.
Yes, that's who I was, replied the ghost. And I knew you in those old times, Everard.
You were made by Rochamandes, and I was made, so to speak, by Benedict.
Everard laughed out loud.
Methinks it was you who made Benedict all right, he said, stealing the blood from him and making him the laughing stock of blood drinkers everywhere. And so you've become a ghost of a blood drinker.
I don't think I'm the only one in this world, said Magnus, but I've had help from my closest friends here, help in becoming what you see before you.
Well, it bears no resemblance to the wicked old hunchback I knew, Everard said.
but he was immediately sorry. He looked down and then up.
"I regret those words," he whispered. "I beg your pardon."
But Magnus was smiling.
"No need to be sorry. I was a frightening creature. One of the great advantages of being a ghost is that you can perfect the etheric body much more profoundly than ever you could the physical body, even with the blood. And so you see me as I had always wanted to look."
It was shaking Everard to his bones that this was Magnus. The Magnus he'd known, yes, and the Magnus who'd made the vampire Lestat, the fledgling who'd changed vampiric history. And yes, he could somehow see through this dazzle and gloss the Magnus that he had known, that wise and brilliant alchemist who'd begged Rosamandes so eloquently for the blood, that healer who'd worked miracles amongst the poor and studied the stars with a bronze telescope before ever Copernicus had become famous for it. This was Magnus, beloved of Notker of Prum, later brought into the blood by Benedict quite deliberately and lovingly. Notker was alive now, somewhere, of that Everard was certain. Rosamandes had said that Notker's music would be heard in the snowy Alps when 1,000 older blood drinkers had gone to their fiery graves. Magnus, a ghost now. And the other? This Raymond Gallant? Who had he been? "Are you hearing the voice now?" asked the ghost named Raymond Gallant.
"No," Everard answered. "He went silent right before I saw you. He's gone. I don't know how I know, but he's gone. I can sort of feel it when he's aiming his magic beam at me as if it were some kind of laser."
He tried not to stare so much at these two. He glanced uneasily at Tescarman.
"Has he never said anything to you about his ultimate purpose?" asked Tescarman. "Has he offered you secrets?"
"Mostly threats," replied Everard. "He's so childish, so stupid. He tries to prey on my fears, my being so very alone of late. But I can see through his tricks. He speaks of unendurable pain and near blindness, and that he is powerless to so much as lift a finger."
"He said those things?
Used those words?" asked Raymond Gallant.
"Yes. He says he's helpless on his own, that he requires my loving assistance, my devotion, my trust in him. As if I should trust him. He says I have powers in me of which I don't dream. And he talks of blood drinkers hiding in Italy and wants me to burn them out. He's merciless."
"But you don't listen to him."
"Why should I?" asked Everard. "And what can I do if this is one of the ancient ones, and if he wants to destroy me? What can I do?"
"You do know how to hide from the fire gift, don't you?" asked Tescarman.
"Your best way is to simply escape. Travel away from this spot as fast as you can, using the cloud gift, if at all possible, to simply get beyond the attacker's range. If you can go swiftly down into the earth, that's even better, because it cannot penetrate the earth. Whoever sends the fire gift has to see the victim, see the building, see the target. That's the only way it can work."
Everard was no expert on any of this. He was more grateful for this clarifying advice, frankly, than he could say. He had to admit Benjy Mahmood had been saying something similar, but he'd never trusted him any more than humans trusted televangelists. And Everard had never been formally taught a thing about the higher gifts. He was not going to confess that all he knew of them he'd learned from the Vampire Chronicles, and that he'd been practicing his skills, if that's what they were, based on descriptions written by disreputable vampire authors like Lestat de Liancourt and Marius de Romanus, and so forth and so on. He let these thoughts roll where they might. Curse the children of Satan and their rules and injunctions. They hadn't cared anything for vampiric gifts. Now the great Rosamandes, his maker, that was another matter. What tales he'd told of riding the winds, and, oh, the spells he could cast, the visions he could arouse for Everard and others. Rosamandes in his burgundy-coloured robes, fingers laden with rings, playing chess at his great inlaid marble chessboard, with those kings and queens and knights and bishops and pawns carved especially for him, to whom he'd given various names. Chess was his favourite game, he declared, because it pitted mind-gift against mind-gift.
"Yes,"
Magnus whispered.
I remember him so very well, and I often sat at that chessboard with him.
Everard would have blushed, had he been human, to have had his thoughts